We'll get started here on lesson 33, which is the captivity. Of course, Mickey's already been working on that. We recognize again where we are on the what we refer to as the western hemisphere of the planet, down there in the sunny Southern California. And what the area that we're, of course, going to be studying now is, as we say, halfway across the world and over here in what are loosely called the Bible lands. And of course, we're studying now more about this area that I have labeled Assyria and Babylonia, or Babylon, because we're now studying about the captivity of the children of Israel. As we go through, it appears that since the northern tribes of Israel were taken away 135 years before the southern tribes were, it doesn't appear that their presence is ever made known again. There may have been some that considered themselves Jews that went back with the return from Babylonian captivity, but I don't recall seeing anything that specifically states that any of the people from the Assyrian captivity and dispersal ever came back to Israel. Now, it's entirely possible that they did, like I say, but when we do speak about the return from captivity later on, after what we're studying now, we realize that what's discussed there mostly refer to tribes, the two tribes of the southern kingdom, and that's about it. So, excuse me. And so we're looking at this rather large area now that encompasses the Babylonian Empire. And, of course, we realize that the Medes and the Persians occupied the area up here, further up toward the, the Black Sea and Caspian Sea and things like that. And then down here into this area down to the east. Apparently, while the Babylonian Empire was in full flower, the Medes here and the Persians here were willing to, you know, stay in their own place, as it were. But later on, those Medes and Persians decided that they liked world dominance good too, so they took over the Babylonian Empire, which apparently they did just by walking in and saying, "Here we are." So. What was the name of the king that had the writing on the wall?
Belshazzar.
And so he was just like drunk, him and everybody in the city or something like that with him at that time, and the Medes and the Persians just walked in and took over. And as it says in our lesson book, they were greeted like they were deliverers. Here, this and that, and then this one right here. It says, where does it say? Prophet of the prince must be paid the son of God faithfully, but the blessing promises. It's down at the end of the paragraph. Turn home, lost. It's not apparently. Okay. I thought for sure it was the last sentence in one of the paragraphs. Anyway, when the Medes and the Persians took over, it was as though that they were just deliverers from the kingdom that they had at that time.
I read a commentary where they made, it was an assumption, but they made the assumption that Balthazar had calculated his time when this captivity would be over. Year that he figured it should, that's why he gave that great big party, and that's when the Medes and Persians came in.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right, so he gave a party to celebrate the fact that the Jews were still there. And
well, that God hadn't done anything.
That God hadn't done anything, yeah. And
he wasn't really the king, was he?
No, he was
the son of the king.
Right.
The king had gone down.
Apparently he lived like in southern Arabia somewhere, or liked it down there for some strange reason. And so he put his son in charge, Belshazzar, while he was gone. And he didn't hang on to it as well as he thought that he might.
The same commentary said that the dad, especially the man,
Nabopolassar, was it?
No, it was like Nabonidus or something.
Oh, Nabonidus.
And he was more of an archaeologist than an
right.
intellect, and so he was optimistic.
That's right, yeah. He was more interested in archaeology and such alike as that. And he was down there, you know, digging in the sands of the Arabian Peninsula.
And it was kind of like too late by the time he came back trying to do something.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So, right. And so the book here, or the chapter here, the lesson 33 on the captivity, refers to Daniel and Ezekiel. And what other book or books do we have that refer to times of the captivity? Esther. Okay, anything else?
Are you talking about Esther and Nehemiah?
They're the return. So they're sort of out of chronological order, as it were, but... Well, that's, you know, it's been said that Job is the oldest book in the Bible, as far as when it was written or when it was written. So it's difficult to tell, and really, and in my daily reading now, I'm in the book of Job, and I keep looking for hints and clues as to where and when that might be, but there's really no... It talks about him being the... one of the wealthiest man of the people of the East. And so, okay. So, East of what? East of Mississippi, I'm sure. But, I don't think that anybody's ever identified exactly when Job was around and exactly where it was that he lived. So, I doubt that he was part of the captivity. However, he was a rich person. And as our lesson 33 talks about it here, what happened to the Jews in the Babylonian captivity to a certain extent?
They prospered.
They prospered. As a matter of fact, they prospered so much that they became quite the leading citizens of that area for many hundreds, thousands of years. And it's one of the reasons why the Muslims don't like them. And one of the reasons why Hitler tried to get rid of them all is because he felt that they were just taking advantage of everybody. Apparently, they ended up being very shrewd businessmen or something. I don't know what it was, but you know what made them prosper like that. But that was one of the reasons that he didn't like them. So apparently, there are a lot of people that didn't like them.
Right in the beginning, Daniel, want to ladder real quick. So
yep.
Very beginning of their captivity, they had people of the Jewish, you know, faith that moved up real quick, like Meshach had a long time ago. So you had some guys that started off at the very beginning of captivity, moving up into the royal palace.
Yes, yeah, people were moving up right away. As a matter of fact, if we go to the book of Esther and we look at Uncle Mordecai, right, and Queen Esther, we realize that they were Jewish people, and
the beginning of the Persians,
yeah, right.
Pretty early in the Persians.
And so they moved up quickly, and then, as you say, Daniel, and of course you meant to say Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, right? And who else? Yeah, there was somebody else. It was, and then Mordecai and Queen Esther. There was somebody else. Oh well. When we look at Ezra and Nehemiah, both of them were in fairly prominent positions before the king at that time, and before the Persian kings at that time. So they were sent down to essentially be the rulers of that. Yeah, Lynn.
If people followed the law, though, I mean, they ate correctly, they treated each other correctly, and so they had different sets of standards. And I can see why they would do better because they were living. If they lived the way God planned for them to live, they would be exceptional people.
Now, if they lived the way that God planned for them to live, what would God do for them?
He would prosper them.
That's right. He would bless them. And if they didn't, and as we look through the lesson here, we see that there's numerous references by the authors here to the book of Ezekiel, and about the how God looks down at the city of Jerusalem, and how he's looking at the evil that's happening in Jerusalem even at that time. And since this is Ezekiel, this is at the time of captivity. Sees that evil things are going on there, and God withdraws his presence from the temple, and God withdraws his presence from the city. And but even in all that, God says, what's the rule, Randy?
You obey me, I'll bless you, and disobey me, I'll curse you.
And he says that in Ezekiel also. And so we see that there's it talks about a sifting and through a sieve, and but I think it says not, but the kernels will not be lost or something like that. And it's talking about the people that are righteous and are following the dictates of God. Let me, whoops, the specific backup folder no longer exists. Well, that's nice to know. He's got the quotation here, unfortunately, from the NIV. Apparently I'm imagining things in my study here. There was a quotation from Ezekiel, and I thought it was embedded here in the lesson, that said that the folks that did things the right way, that they would be blessed. It spoke about them specifically. I guess it's here in this paragraph, says the threats of captivity. Unfortunately, I've scanned this thing in and I've reformatted it in a word processor. So the page pagination is not the same as in your book. But wherever it says there, the threats of captivity for God's people were followed by a promise of a return of a remnant. We already noted Moses' warning in Deuteronomy 28. Now look at chapter 30. Moses says, God will remember you and bring you back to your homeland, even if you are scattered to the most distant land under heaven. It's not the quote that I was looking for, but that's essentially what we're talking about here. It's amazing how I can read these things and then not find them again. nobody else has that problem, I'm sure. So, no. What?
133, just about the middle.
Good. That doesn't mean anything to me, but...
No. Everyone except you.
Yeah. What's a paragraph? How does it start?
The one that you were reading, the threats of captivity for God's people?
Yeah.
We're followed by a promise of a return to them.
Right under Ezekiel's vision, it says that Amos would... It was Amos who said it, not Ezekiel.
Oh, it was Amos, yeah, right. Okay.
So it was right under where you were.
Yeah, but I can't find where I was now.
That's on page 133.
Doesn't do me any good. That was a major threat. Oh, right there. My cursor's still there. Ezekiel, okay, the prophet Amos, yeah, okay. Oh, there it is. As a sieve, but not a kernel, a righteous individual will be lost. Amos 9, 8 through 10. Okay. Right there on page 133. Okay, I knew that. All right. Yeah, see, I don't have any page numbers here. Okay, so there's, and I guess several of you have been studying the book of Ezekiel for quite a while now, I guess. And but there's a lot of prophecy in there about what's going to happen to Jerusalem and the situation that they're in and things like that. Now, Ezekiel was in what situation in the captivity? Was he a high up official in the court of the king?
Well, he was with the common people.
Right. He was with the common people. So
there was a set of part land that he was in with a lot of Jews that had that.
Right, that river Kibar, which these folks say is an irrigation canal which I'm sure everybody would love to live by an irrigation canal. And
it was supposed to be a very fertile place.
Yeah. Oh, this is my word perfect, so I guess this is sideways. anyway, let me go back to my maps that are right here, I hope. So, yeah, they did actually go to about 200% here. So on the map that's on page, what is this, 136, I think. Is that right? We have of course, the city of Babylon right here. And when it talks about the people, they lived by this town named Erech, which was on the Euphrates, close to the Euphrates River anyway. And so this river, Kibar, is where they lived. The folks in the book say that this was an irrigation canal, awfully long irrigation canal, but still, that's where they were. Is Tema? Is that where? I want to say this town here, Tema, down here toward the in the Arabian Peninsula. That's the one where Daddy went to do his archaeological discoveries while Belshazzar stayed up here and wasted the kingdom. So,
is that in Scripture or is that
yeah. Let me see. See if we can get a reference on that. If I can remember where I am. Oh, here. Well, maybe you're right. Maybe it is more in secular history than it is. All right, it says, right before where it says label Tema in Arabia, Nabonidus was the last one on the throne. This may be coming from secular history then. I don't know if I remember seeing anything. It just mentions that Belshazzar was in charge and he was having this big party. Yeah. Okay.
It calls him the king.
It does. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So he in essence was. And
so it calls Darius the king too. Darius was not the ruler. He was on the territory ruler.
Oh, like one of the satraps or whatever they call them. And
yeah, it was before that time. Still had nobles that he put over different areas.
Now, Darius came after Cyrus, right? It was
yeah.
Cyrus, and then
Prophet.
Cyrus was the one that really expanded the kingdom, I think. And he actually fought with wasn't he the one that fought with the Greeks, right? And had the big battle, and he was over. I think that movie, The 300, was about. A battle.
That's later. That's
what
later.
I thought. Okay. Oh, okay. Right. Randy.
I was going to say Daniel 5 ends 30-31 says that same night Belshazzar the Chaldean king was slain, so Darius the Mede received the kingdom at the age of 62.
Okay. Daniel 5.
Yeah, Daniel 5 ends that way. And Daniel 6 begins with Darius and Darius or however it goes.
Interesting. All right. Yeah. And that night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. Okay.
And actually, the secular history calls it a co-regent with his dad.
Co-regent, yeah.
And in the first chapter, I believe it's the first, when he's seeing the handwriting, his wife comes out and she calls Nebuchadnezzar his father, but Nebuchadnezzar wasn't related to him at all.
Oh, I thought that he was his grandfather.
Not even related to him.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of like one of those Eastern flower
Right, right. Yeah, there in verse 18, this is Daniel speaking, but it's the same thing. The Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father the kingdom and greatness and glory and majesty. And I think, like you say, his wife said the same thing. the queen, there he is. By reason of the words of the king, came to the banquet house, O king. In the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom like the ones found in him. And the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, the king, I say, thy father made him master of the magicians. Talking about Daniel. So, okay, but you say that they weren't related at all? Okay. Do we see that biblically, or we don't see that? We just see a succession. Okay. Let's see.
Yes. Then Darius was the seventh king under Cyrus.
Okay. Oh, under Cyrus?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're talking in chapter 4 of Daniel, in verse 34, or all the way down to the end there. Here we have, this is stuff that's written in, just lost the name of the language. Not Hebrew, but
Aramaic.
This is part that's written in Aramaic, and in a couple of places here, you say it's at the end in verse 34, I, Nebuchadnezzar. And then at verse 36, he's talking in the first person. At the same time, mine understanding returned to me. And verse 37, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol it and honor the King of heaven for all his works of truth and his ways justice and those that walk in pride, he is able to abase. And then verse chapter 5, it says, Belshazzar the king. So, we've apparently gone, at least according to our workbook, three more kings past this. So Nabopolassar, I guess, was in there, but then apparently there was another king or two between Nebuchadnezzar and Nabopolassar.
Well, wouldn't he have had to do something when he went
cuckoo? Yeah.
I mean, they would have had to have somebody ruling, right?
Yeah. The thing is that we don't know how long that was, but it said that his fingernails were as long like eagle's claws, and his hair was even longer than mine. But I got a haircut yesterday. So it was obviously a while, yeah. And so somebody had to reign in his place. So difficult to say who. So we'd have to go. I've got my secular history book sitting there, which doesn't do me much good down on the bench. But it does jump a bit here. So
verse 32 of chapter 4 of Daniel.
Yeah, 32.
It says seven periods of time.
Yeah.
My notes say, i.e. years.
Oh. I don't
know if that's speculation or if that's actually an expression that's confirmable. That would be long enough to have long fingernails.
Yeah, it would.
I don't know.
What's I hate to do this, but let me see. Verse 32. See what the NIV says. 32. You look at the wild. 7 years, they say. And if we go to the Bible in Basic English, which I'm sure is a great book. Seven times, well, that didn't help much. Easy to read version. Seven seasons, okay. Well, we just go back up there to the American Standard where it says the very clear.
Clearly
seven times. Yeah. It's not just 7 days or anything like that, obviously. So somebody had to reign in that time.
That would be a perfect time for a coup as well.
It would. Yeah. It's like, what's his name that went in and meets the Persians? He had his opportunity right then. okay. I guess one of the things, and I mentioned this, or we mentioned this the last time, is that there's not a lot of day-to-day recitation of what went on in the people's lives at this time. Now, but we do note that if we go over here to Esther, actually, I think Esther is probably one of the best ones to show us something of the lives of the people to a certain extent. We see that just in the first verse of Esther, it says, it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This is Ahasuerus who reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces. And it is Ahasuerus that was able to expand the kingdom through Egypt and get down to Ethiopia, but apparently that didn't last very long because the Egyptians were still pretty strong for him to maintain a presence with his arm extended that far. But at some time or other, he was able to get down to Ethiopia and make this claim. As a matter of fact, I saw something that indicated that, I think it was Ahasuerus, or it may have been one of the kings around that area, actually dug a canal from the Nile over to the Gulf of Suez so that they could navigate around the Arabian Peninsula and go up the Gulf of Suez and then get into Egypt by boat on the Nile River. I don't remember ever hearing anything about that before, but this guy here, Cyrus Gordon, in this ancient Near East book that I have, says that he did that. Wow. Think that that would be something that everybody would know about, but I've never heard of it before. I'm not sure it would be all that good for the Nile River to be draining into the Gulf of Suez, or have the Gulf of Suez draining into the Nile River. So salt water and fresh water don't do good there. But notice that it says that he's over 127 provinces. He reigned from India even to Ethiopia. Now, when it came time to send out the decrees to have the Jews destroyed, it said that they went by messenger, apparently via horse and rider, to these 127 different provinces. But the declaration, you'll note, went out, it says, to all 127 provinces. Now, it may be that, you know, when they were sending out messengers, they just sent it out to everybody, even though it didn't seem to pertain to them. But this also gives us the implication, anyway, that Jewish people lived in some, if not all, of these provinces, from India all the way to Ethiopia. And it says that it was written in their particular native languages, so it went out to all the different peoples in their own languages. But I think also the thing is that later on, when the decree of relief, or whatever you call it, was sent out, the one that allowed the Jewish people to defend themselves, we see that the implication in the book is that that there are a lot of Jewish people around. They ended up killing, the Jewish people ended up killing, 4,000 just in Shushan, let me get it right here, find it here, the palace anyway. Shushan, yeah. Destroyed 500. And note, all of these, and in Shushan they destroyed. Note that then all of these other places, whoops, that worked out well. Where was I? Push buttons. 9-6, yes. Push the right button, it'll work. So it says Shushan the palace, where the Jews were. They slew these people. This is the palace. But then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 10 other somethings. I don't know what they are, whether they're cities or areas of that particular city. Shushan, of course, was just the palace. We see here that the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword. And
good number 16.
16.
The greater number.
Okay, that's where it is. All right. So verse 16, talking about the other Jews that were in the king's provinces gathered themselves together and stood for their lives and had rest from their enemies and slew of them that hated them 75,000. But on the spoil they laid not their hand. And then that was done on the 13th day. And then on the 14th day, but the people in Shushan continued on the 14th day. Well, it was here somewhere. But somebody couldn't complete their task or didn't get the message or something like that on the 13th day. And they continued doing this on the 14th day. It had to do with the unwalled towns and the walled towns. Okay. So, therefore, the Jews in the villages that dwell in unwalled towns make the 14th day of the month of Adar a gladness of feasting, and so on. And the Jews were in Shushan, assembled on the 13th day, and on the 14th and 15th day of the same day, rested, make a day of feasting and gladness. What Jewish holiday is this, by the way, now?
Purim.
Purim, right.
And that was just Thursday of last week.
Oh, what was Thursday of last week?
Like that.
No, okay. All right, so it's interesting here to note that we have a discussion of things that are in the Book of Esther. In the, where are we now? We're in the 500 and, say we're in the late 500s BC, something like that, or somewhere in that neighborhood. And here is a really an extra-biblical feast, as it were, that is established at this time that is continued by the Jewish observant people to this day. So we see here that this feast of Purim was established at this time as a result of what happened with the Jews there at the time of Esther. And it's still around today. Of course, there's many of the feasts that God established that are still around today, too, in those people that still observe Judaism. What this is showing us, though, is that there were Jews all over the place in this kingdom, apparently, and they were in a condition such that they were able to defend themselves, and so it's not like then that they were all shut up in prisons or slaves with chains on and things like that. But rather that they were living in the various different provinces of the king and carrying out their normal everyday lives, essentially as Babylonian or Median Persian citizens, whatever, a citizen of that kingdom, whatever rights they might have had. And as I was reading through the secular history book, it was interesting to note that Whereas the Assyrians were very cruel in their punishment of defeated people, and though they took them away and put them in other lands, they did not give them, apparently, the freedom that the Babylonian captors did. Apparently, the Babylonians just said, look, we take them away from their homeland and put them somewhere else, then they won't have any cohesiveness. They won't be able to, their political nature will not be able to survive. They'll simply revert to us. Now, I think one of the things that we can say, though, is that this just seemed to make the Jews stronger, at least as near as I can tell. Chris, were you about to put your hand up?
Yeah. It also, when you tie this in with Daniel also, you see that at least there were four young men. I would assume they were not the only four, who refused to completely assimilate into Babylonian culture, that they held fast and perhaps had a renewed focus and dedication to serving God and doing what's right. Again, I can only imagine that there were more than those four who stood fast, and that you turn that back to Deuteronomy 30 and how that God said, when this happens, when you are taken away, that you're going to remember. And unfortunately, it took this to get to perhaps cause them to remember who they are as a nation and people, and at least perhaps through the leadership of Daniel and those three friends, or perhaps countless others, we don't know, to remember that we are who we are and we're not served up.
Yeah, a goodly number of people were taken away at that time, at 606. And then later on in 586, then when the city was destroyed, then more people were taken away. But yeah, there, since all of those people were taken away at that time, along with Daniel and the three others, yes, obviously there must have been more of them around that were willing to, or decided that they needed to follow their instructions as Jews, rather than to just completely assimilate themselves into Babylonian society.
Because in Esther, when the edict went out to annihilate the Jews, they knew who they were.
That's right. Yeah, they did know who they were. That's right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, there must have been some way to tell them, that's for sure. I hadn't thought about that, but yes, there certainly had to be some way that they knew that these people were Jewish people. So, as a matter of fact, the idea here is, and once again, I think this is, again, from secular history, because I'm not sure I see the mention of synagogues in any of these captivity books, but when we come back to the discussion of Jewish people in the New Testament, we see that we have synagogue worship. That was never the case previously. It was always just temple worship. That anything other than the temple was forbidden. But by the time we get to the New Testament, we see that there's a well-established practice of synagogue worship. And we know that they had synagogues in the various cities. We see that when Paul went around on the various journeys that he took, that he was able to go to a synagogue in almost every city that he went in.
I think it's mentioned in the Talmud, the Jewish traditions, the synagogues are mentioned in there.
Okay, in the Talmud? Yeah. Okay. So it appears that's where these were set up. So as with many people, when they get persecuted, they have a tendency to find like-minded people and band together. I think it curious, though, that when the book of the law was delivered to Josiah, that he found it essentially a new thing to him, because when it was read by the scribe, I forgot his name, starts with an S, Shaphan the scribe, when it was read to him, Josiah was extremely upset, because he realized at that time that they weren't following the law of God. And so at that time, apparently they didn't know the law of God or were not particularly familiar with it. Yet when... Linda? But when they go off into Babylonian captivity here, apparently they know something, and they apparently know enough of the law in order to set up eventually synagogue worship. Now I guess we have to realize that if we look at the northern 10 tribes having been taken away into Assyrian captivity, and we look at the southern two tribes were taken away into Babylonian captivity, that a lot of people would have known the law, you know, as it were, by heart. And perhaps they were able to find a bunch of like-minded people when they went into Babylonian captivity. I don't know. Because the Assyrians had taken away so many of the people of the northern tribes and scattered them about also. What they did with them, it doesn't say. But it does say that's where the Samaritans started, right? Is that they took the people from the 10 tribes away and they put other peoples in their land. And that was the beginning of the Samaritans. What a neat bell. okay. There's another point I was going to make. Now I can't remember what it was. But there were a lot of Jewish people around, apparently. And then, that's one. When we actually do get to the return from captivity then, though, we realize that if we're just talking about the people from the northern 10 tribes, the ones that have been there the longest have been there how long?
At what point?
When they return from Babylonian captivity, the ones that have been there in Babylonian captivity the longest have been there for how long? For 70 years. That means that the people that have been in Assyrian captivity have been there for 100 or 200 years, approximately. So if any of them came back.
There was some of them came back, because there's some of the, in the New Testament, there was mention of some people from different tribes.
Yeah, that's right. There is a mention of people from other tribes. The thing we have to realize, though, is that even after just 70 years of living in that land, their children and their grandchildren would have considered that land to be their home. I mean, they lived there all of their lives, a lot of them.
A lot of them didn't come back.
No, they didn't. That's right.
I read some book and it estimated it was something like 3 to 4 or 5 million people, Jews, in the captivity land. Some of them all the way over to the media. And only 55,000 came back.
Right, because we have a listing of the, essentially, and a numbering of the people that came back. And if it was only 55,000, and yet there were several million Jews in existence at that time, then it would appear that a good majority of them decided that, well, where they lived was their home. And apparently they felt that they could carry out their religion and do the things that God wanted them to do in that way. And we see that as we come on up into more contemporary times, that we do come across these people all the time. Carolyn?
Well, with what you were just saying, in the New Testament, when they talk about all the Jews who came from all over to come to Jerusalem, and then a little later, Paul, you know, traveled all over and found them, that would bear that out.
Right. And who did Philip meet on the road? An Ethiopian. So he was all the way from like 1,000 miles south of there.
A
large Jewish population
Jews
down there.
Alexandria, too.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, that's where the Septuagint was translated and stuff. There's a large group of Jews there. And that's it, so
yeah, it would be interesting to note that the Septuagint was translated in Alexandria, which was in Egypt. And so it was just a sort of a scholarly thing, I guess, but the Jews were there. Randy?
I was just going to give a perspective verse.
A perspective verse, okay.
Big picture. In Matthew chapter 1.
Matthew 1.
17. It says, so all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations. And to the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, 14 generations.
Mm-hmm. 52, right? Hmm? 42.
14 times 3?
42. Yep. 42, yes.
But no, it's just interesting to look at that and realize that that's what we're talking about. We're right at the deportation to Babylon. Now, so it's 14 generations from the time they were taken.
Yeah.
Until the Messiah.
Right. Okay, so from David to the carrying away, 14. From the carrying away unto the Christ, 14. So the length of time from the reign of David till the time that they were carried away was 14 generations. Well, I think that we looked at that the other day. We had a chart on that. I think it wasn't that the 450-something years thing? There was a chart in one of the, probably in 32. No, it was in 31. There was a chart that listed the time period from, I think, from David until the end of the end of the kingdoms, and was in the 450-year range. So, which sounds about right, is that we feel that the intertestamental period was about 400 years, I think, right? So, that sounds...
If you consider Babylon, that was 70 years of captivity. Closer
to 500. Yeah, closer to 500. Yeah, and of course the number, the word generations does not lend itself to an exact counting of years. So, but it's a long piece of time. All right, thank you.